Hello, I'm Matt Baume, and welcome to The Sewers of Paris. We're on a podcast search for the entertainment that changed the lives of queer people. On tonight's episode, The Great British Bake Off, musical theater, and Peter Pan. This week, we're diving into the Sewers of Paris archives to revisit my 2020 interview with Max Miller. He's the creator of the Tasting History YouTube channel and author of the book Tasting History, which comes out this week. In Max's video series, he shares historical recipes and intriguing stories about the origin of the foods that humans have eaten throughout history, and his book expands on that work. It was inspired in part by Max's appreciation for the Great British Bake Off, and at first, he didn't intend for his videos to be anything other than a fun hobby to entertain family and friends, which is why nobody was more surprised than him when it took off, making unexpected use of his background in musical theater and his time swinging from the rafters of a cruise ship. We'll have that conversation in a minute. First, a reminder that I've got a book of my own about to come out in May. It's tracing the history of queer characters on American sitcoms, and it's entitled Hi Honey, I'm Homo. I'll be hosting live book readings around the country to celebrate the launch. So far, we have New York, Chicago, and Seattle on the calendar, and we're about to add Portland. Plus, there's more on the way. Check out the details at gaysitcoms.com or subscribe to my weekly newsletter for all the latest at mattbaume.com. Now, here's my 2020 conversation with Max. Well, this week I'm speaking to the host and creator of Tasting History, Max Miller. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So what is the entertainment that changed your life?
You know, if you had asked me 6 months ago, it would have been a different answer. But now I have to say the Great British Bake Off.
Understandable how it's life-changing for many different people. What is the, like, is it possible for you even to look back over the last few months and describe what the inspiration of that show has done for you?
It really has changed my life so completely. It inspired me to start cooking. I had never boiled an egg until 6 years ago. It's funny how something that is a bad thing can turn out to actually be a wonderful thing, and you just don't know. So I went to Disney World with a friend over New Year's some years back, and she got terribly sick. And we spent almost the entire vacation in the hotel room, just eating nachos and binge-watching TV shows, including The Great British Bake Off. She introduced me to it. And I mean, that was, you know, ruined trip to Disney World. But I was so inspired by that show that I went home and said, I'm going to learn how to bake every single thing that they baked on that show. And in doing so, and it was just one season that I had watched. And in doing so, though, it was, I learned how to bake. I taught myself how to bake and turned everything.
That is so ambitious, because they do so much on that show. Like, where did you start?
I started, you know, I'm insane. You know what? I didn't know any better is what it was. I didn't know that trying to make the first thing that you cook be a Battenberg cake, which is this kind of, it's a kind of a long square cake that is covered in marzipan. And when you slice into it, there's four different squares of cake in the middle, so it looks kind of like a little checkerboard. And I said, that's the first thing that I'm going to bake. And, you know, something that I've always been very good at is following directions and measuring extremely precisely. And the show, the great thing about that show that's very different from American cooking shows, and I have to admit, it's kind of gotten away from this. But if you look at the earlier seasons, you could learn so much about how to do what they were doing by watching them do it, because the judges would give useful critiques saying, oh, no, you want to add the salt and the yeast in on different sides of the bowl before mixing, and just little things like that. I was able to learn a lot of little techniques just by watching the show. And then they used to have like little episodes called Masterclass, where Paul Hollywood and Mary Berry would teach you how to make some of the things. And they would go step by step. And it's like, if you do exactly what they're doing, you're going to end up with exactly what they end up with.
Going from not having boiled an egg to making a Battenberg is like quite a leap. Like, how did those early attempts turn out? Like, Were you able to do it?
It's funny. Those first attempts they actually turned out really, really well. What started to get difficult was when I decided I wanted to do bread. It seemed like bread was going to be the easiest thing because it's just, you know, it's bread. It's everywhere. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, bread is so hard because there are so many things that can go wrong. You can't just follow the directions. There's so much. It's a little bit more artistic in a way, because you have to know what it feels like. You have to know what it's supposed to look like at certain stages during the process. So there were a lot of things that ended up in the trash, but I had fun doing it. And even today, a lot of stuff does not end up on the show, you know, a lot of stuff ends up in the trash. But I enjoy the mistakes. I get frustrated and, you know, sometimes want to throw things across the room. But afterward, once I've calmed down, I'm like, oh, I learned something that now I can apply to not only this dish, but the next time I make something that's similar to it.
Did it feel like when you started making those foods and having those successes in the kitchen, like you had, I don't know, like unlocked some part of yourself that you just weren't aware of?
Absolutely. I mean, it's... I had always joked. I lived in New York before moving here to LA, and in New York, I never cooked. My oven, I stored books in my oven. I mean, I did not cook, and I wore that as a bit of a badge of honor, or at least I told myself I did. I think it was actually because I was embarrassed that I couldn't cook. My mother and father cook, but they never taught me how to cook. And it's not on them. It's on me just not being a good student. So then when I started to actually give it a go, you know, I had been afraid before that, but when I started to give it a go, I realized I really enjoy it. And especially baking. I find baking is like, if you know Harry Potter at all, and you know the scene where Professor Snape says that potions are like a very precise art form. That's what I think of as baking as. You know, it's so precise. You can't get anything, even the littlest bit wrong, or else everything just implodes. And I kind of love that.
Yeah, especially like with bread, for example. It's literally a living organism that's making it so bready. So you've got to be a good steward to it.
Yeah. And there's just so many things that can go wrong. Like, you know, the amount of sugar that you add in a cake can completely change the texture. Or what do your, you know, is your oven actually 400 degrees or is it 405 degrees? I mean, just very, very different things. And that's always part of the reason that I like baking from English books. And on my show, I always include weights. You know, I do include volume for Americans who don't tend to have scales in their kitchen, but everywhere else in the world, you have a scale in the kitchen usually, and everything is kind of done by grams. And so if you pick up an English baking book, very often, even the eggs are done by weight. So because two of your eggs and two of my eggs are not going to actually be the same. And in baking, that can be life or death.
Can you tell me about like your background? You mentioned that you hadn't baked before, but it seems like you're very comfortable on camera and you've got a great like just charisma when you're talking to people, an audience about food. So what was, did you have like a background that prepared you for the kind of videos you're making now?
You know, yes. Though it's not necessarily what you think, you know, you're going to end up doing. You learn a skill for some completely opposite reason, and then you apply it to something new. I was an actor on the stage in New York. I performed at Carnegie Hall and Lincoln Center and City Center Encores and on cruise ships and tour and everything. And, you know, just all of that time being on stage, you do tend to have to learn eventually how to be a little bit more comfortable with yourself. And then I was also a singer. That's what my degree is in classical voice. And so just using that kind of performance part of you can be very, very helpful in what I do now, as well as all of the foreign words that I come across. People are always like, oh, you must speak so many languages, because I had to learn how to pronounce languages properly for singing. Even if I don't speak Russian, because I don't, I had to learn how to pronounce it like I could speak it natively. So I've been able to apply that to a lot of episodes.
Yeah, I've had opera singers on the show who've said the same thing. Like they just have to sound really expert in saying the words that they have no idea what the words actually are.
Exactly. It's a little bit of a trick, but But yeah, I never thought that my German and French diction classes in college mm-hmm. would ever really be put to use. And now I use them every day. So you never know.
Is that what brought you to New York? Like, did you come to New York thinking like, all right, I'm going to be a stage actor?
Yeah. Yeah. So right after college, I went to college at ASU, Arizona State, for music, classical music, and then British history was my other degree. But I decided fairly early on in getting my degree that I didn't want to do classical music, that I wanted to do musical theater. And so that's why I moved to New York and pursued musical theater. And I had some luck, but, you know, I was not comfortable with myself. Often casting directors would say, oh, be yourself. And I would not. I always was trying to be what I thought they wanted me to be. And you can't. It rings false. And that's why when I started tasting history, it wasn't for anyone. It was for my friends and my mom, who already know that I, you know, have bad jokes and silly things to say. And so I was able to be myself. And oddly enough, that translated well.
Mm-hmm. Were there shows, like, when you made that decision that you wanted to focus on musical theater, like, was there a particular show or experiences that helped you make that decision?
So many. You know, I grew up watching a lot of old movies with my Nana. She always had Turner Classic Movies on. So I think that I watched Camelot and My Fair Lady and Cabaret 100 times growing up. And so those shows in particular, I just, you know, I could always see myself as a Freddie Eynsford Hill, or the MC, though I never got to play that.
As a Freddie? Really?
Yeah, that was actually my bread and butter. I played Freddie Eynsford Hill in no less than a dozen productions of My Fair Lady around the country. And you know what? It's a great role to play because the show is long. My Fair Lady yeah. is a 3-hour show, and Freddie Eynsford Hill is on stage for probably all of 8 minutes, maybe 10 minutes.
I was going to say it's not something that's easy to sink your teeth into.
No, but I always loved the song, and that was actually always a problem for me. Was I was always the singer rather than the actor. You know, I approached musical theater from the musical side. Coming from classical voice, you know, that made sense. And for some shows, that really works. For Les Miserables or Phantom of the Opera, where they're really heavily vocal, you know, things like that, I always excelled in those types of shows. Not that I ever got to do Phantom, but for so many other shows, really, you need to approach it as an actor. And I never did. When I started to actually approach things as an actor was when I started to leave musical theater and I decided that I wanted to do voiceover. And I did some time. It sounds like I was in prison. I did some time. I started doing voiceover for a bit of animation and singing, you know, behind the mic. And so it forces you to be an actor because you can't use your body. You can't use, or you are using your body, but you can't be seen doing anything. So all of the emotion, all of the acting has to come through your voice. And I really learned a lot doing that.
And was that in New York that you were able to do that, or after you moved to LA?
It was actually after I moved to LA. Hmm. I just did it for a few years, but I really enjoyed it.
You mentioned that it was an issue in New York that you were trying to give people what you thought they wanted, and they're, you know, they'd be like, be yourself. And you're like, okay, but which myself do you want?
Yeah. And I think that a lot of people have this, that you want to impress the people that you're auditioning for. You want the job so bad. Not because you want to be on stage, but because you don't want to be serving tables next month. You want to be eating, you know. Mm-hmm. You want that job so bad that it comes across as, I guess, needy would be the word. And I think it's very easy to fall into that trap. And it takes some people very little time to get to know themselves well enough that they don't need that. And it takes some people longer. It took me longer. I was not one of those people who in 6 months was like, oh, now I'm very confident. And it took me longer. And that's okay, because I, you know, you never know how things will turn out.
Yeah, there must be a lot of pressure also, like, just wrapped up in moving from, like, Arizona to New York. Like, it seems like, I imagine New York must seem like, well, that's the place. That's where all the actors, that's where you go to make it or break it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, especially for musical theater, it's kind of there or London. You say there's a lot of pressure. There is, not even just, you know, you're putting it on yourself, but from your friends and family, even if they're not actively pressuring you, if you aren't succeeding, then you kind of feel like, oh, I've let them down. And it's a hard place. It's a hard place to live doing a very difficult industry. But it's a lot of fun too. So I loved it. I mean, those were the best years of my life. So
yeah, well, I mean, I'm sure there was a reason that you were like, all right, this is what I want to do, like in college, and then I'm sticking with this in New York.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I loved being on stage. I loved the performing. It's what you
learned. You love about it?
I mean, I like attention, obviously. I wouldn't be putting stuff on YouTube if I didn't like attention. So there was that. But there was also, I've always loved playing pretend, you know? Telling stories in any capacity, whether that was writing them or performing them on stage or singing them. I've just always kind of, it's a way to, I had a wonderful childhood, so this is going to sound terrible, but it's a way to escape from your reality. My reality was wonderful, but it was still a way to be someone else, you know? It's a lot of fun, but the lifestyle around it is rough.
Sure, sure. Yeah. Did you find like support from other people like in your industry? Or I imagine like moving from Arizona to New York, like very different gay community from one place to the other?
Yeah. I never had any lack of support. I have been very fortunate from my family to my friends to many people in the industry. We're always very supportive.
Well, you know, you said that one of the appeals for you was that you could escape and be someone else. And something that I've, you know, other actors that I've interviewed on the show have mentioned is the difficulty of balancing that, like, be someone else and escape and discover someone new while also having the germ of truth about who you are in there,
right,
as well.
It's true. It's hard. And it's finding that balance. I mean, that's why there are some actors and you're like, oh, they're always kind of the same. And it's like, well, yeah, but they're really good at it because that's them. They're altering a little bit for the role or whatever, but you can find a lot of truth in their performances. And I know now why I had trouble doing that very often. And it's the same reason that even now on camera, I'm not comfortable on camera. I honestly don't like it. I wish I could do Tasting History audio version only. I used to be extremely overweight in high school and then in college, and I lost about almost 100 pounds. But when you grow up overweight or have anything like that that people can ridicule you for, it never leaves you. You know, it's like once a fat kid, always a fat kid. It never leaves you. And so I have never been comfortable with the way that I look, no matter how I look. And when you're on stage, that's a detriment. You know, if you look like you're uncomfortable, that's going to make the audience uncomfortable. And that was always an issue for me.
What happened what was behind the move from New York to LA?
So I was living in New York and I was kind of done with the lifestyle, done with the summers. People always said, oh, you'll hate the winters in New York. It was the summers that killed me. It was, you know, just miserably hot and always being poor. I had the opportunity to perform on Disney Cruise Line. And what jumped out to me was, you get to leave New York for an entire year and live on a cruise ship. And, you know, I spent months in Toronto and then in Germany and then in the Caribbean. And I was like, okay. And they paid well. And I love Disney. So it was kind of a no-brainer. And while I was there, half of the people who were in the cast with me lived in LA. And I was not a hard sell. they all loved LA, everything about LA. And so I said, okay, when I'm done here, I'm packing up, moving to LA. And I had realized just before that I kind of wanted to start doing voice acting. So LA was a great place to do that. And it was closer to my family in Phoenix, and I get to see them a lot more often now. Mm. So it was a pretty easy move for me.
What was the work on the cruise lines like?
That was the best year of my life. It was heaven. I'm sure that it was actually a lot more difficult when I was in it. It was a brand new ship, so it was the Disney Dream. We were rehearsing while they were still finishing building it in December in northern Germany on the North Sea. So it was freezing cold in the ship, and I was playing Peter Pan on wires, and so we would be out in the rough seas and I'd be swinging around. But oh, I know it was madness. But once we got into the flow of things and got the shows on their feet, while we were going around the Caribbean, we didn't work very much. You know, most people on cruise ships work hellish hours. Mm-hmm. Very, very long hours. But the performers don't work as many, and we were treated extremely well. It was basically like that last 8 months was basically an 8 month Bahamian vacation.
Wow, that does sound good.
I read a lot. I mean, I was reading probably two books a week out, you know, on the beach, and then doing shows at night. It was lovely.
Oh, that sounds great. And I know like British history is like a big deal for you. So it was, were you like absorbing a lot of that kind of stuff as well?
I was. It was actually while I was on the ship that I found a passion for Anglo-Saxon England. Hmm. I had always kind of studied the latter part of English history, Victorian England and kind of the 18th century as well. But I picked up a book by an author named Peter Rex, and it was called 1066, and it told the story basically going from 1049 until just after 1075. And in those years, it transferred from Anglo-Saxon England to Norman England, which is, you know, kind of William the Conqueror, what we know as England, medieval England. And that period of transition, I've always kind of been drawn to periods of transition and how people deal with them, because you know, you learn about the generals and the kings and the dukes and how they dealt with it. But it's like, how did the people deal with this? And there's a lot that you can learn about how the people of England were dealing with this transition, because it's very well documented. The change in language, the change in obviously who you're paying rent to, but the total change in structure of society. The very violent change as well. But so I became obsessed with this time period. And in the last 6 months that I was there, I ended up reading probably about 50 books on the subject and just absorbed everything I possibly could on the subject, and always now wanted to write a book about it. I have dabbled, but I still haven't had the time to actually do it. But one of these days, I'm going to.
Well, so you've got this like foundation now of like this historical foundation that you're coming to, like when you move to LA, you've got all this like knowledge that you've built up over the years. So I guess like not really realizing it at the time, you were kind of primed to have some fluency when it comes to like British food history.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's crazy, because it was, like I said, it's never anything that I intended to use professionally, nor were the pronouncing words or really anything that I'm doing today, I never intended to make any money off of. It was all stuff that I had a passion for. And it, you know, if you can take all of your passions and put them together, I guess people respond to that. If you can, you know, get people to listen to you, because I always find it exciting to hear about something from somebody who has a passion for it. Even if I don't care about it, I couldn't, you know, care less about football. But if I'm talking to someone who really loves the sport and knows a lot about it, I'll get sucked in and find it very interesting. Granted, when I walk away, then, you know, back to not really caring. But if you have a passion for something and you can speak to it, it's magnetic. no matter what the subject.
So you're watching Great British Bake Off, and we actually talked about this in another interview a few weeks ago, that they have these little history segments, right, that, mm-hmm. that really caught your eye with Mel and Sue.
Yeah, so those were my favorite parts of the show. And then Sue had actually also done a show called Supersizers Go, which was basically all history and food, and there were only like 7 or 8 episodes, I think. But I loved her take on things. Both of them, they have this wonderfully, you know, the dry British sense of humor with cheesy puns and bad jokes, which I think are wonderful jokes sometimes. And then those sections left the show when it left BBC. I think they tried it once afterward, and it just didn't fly with the new hosts. So I miss them. And that's partly what I tried to model Tasting History after. Not so much in the way that Tasting History is, like the actual format is nothing like what they did, but the feeling that I got when I watched those shows is the feeling that I try to have my viewer get while I'm explaining history to them, if that makes any sense at all.
Yeah, and it really seems like you're in your element there, both talking about the food that you clearly are very passionate about and the history. And the, like you were saying before, you like to tell a story. And I think that's something that's really magnetic about your videos, the storytelling of the people and the food and the history and the actual story of how we got from A to B with a particular recipe.
Yeah, I mean, that's what history is. It's stories. Mm-hmm. And so many people are taught it. I don't want to say they're taught it wrong, but they're taught it in a very dry way that they can't, you know, they can't latch on to it. This has nothing to do with me, but of course it has something to do with you. But it has to be told as a story. And that's what I try to do.
When you moved to LA and started doing more voice work, I know you said that you started to become a little bit more comfortable in just the way that you were presenting yourself and taking on roles. What did you, like, looking back, what changed?
Big thing that changed was, you know, sometimes it's like one person in your life can make a huge difference. For me, that was a man named Bob Bergen. He's the voice of Porky the Pig, amongst many others, but that's kind of his bread and butter. He's a fantastic voice actor who's been doing it for years, and he took me on as a student. And we had so much in common, not just voice acting, but, you know, we had both been overweight. We were both gay. We had a similar sense of humor. And I think seeing him, he became such a role model for me, seeing him be so comfortable behind a mic and be so weird and let loose and not care one iota what person on the other side of the window, or in a recording studio, the window, was thinking about him. Taking his classes, he was able to get that out of me. He was able to pull that, stop caring what I think, and I'll actually think well of you. Mm-hmm. Ironically, it's like, if you don't care what I think, then I'll think it's good. He was able to pull that out of me. And I had never had a teacher who had been able to get me to do that. So,
did that feel like you're sort of meeting yourself for the first time?
Yes. I mean, I was about 30, I guess, when I was doing this. And I don't know if it was partly, you know, my age and partly this and just a lot of different things, but my confidence just completely reset in a way that I had never had it before. And I was so happy. I enjoyed being around myself for the first time, maybe ever. You know, I was like, I am funny, even if you don't think so. I think so. And I like to hear what I have to say. And I think that's something that, you know, it's something that everyone should strive to get to. And I'm still working on it, of course. You know, I still can like myself better. And it's not an ego or self-centered kind of thing. It's more of a, I'm okay with who I am, and that's just it. And you need to be okay with who I am too, because you're not getting anyone else. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was a huge change, a sea change in a very short period of time, less than a year.
Wow. Do you find that changed how you, like, not just in your performance, but just like carried yourself around other people and like changed the how you interacted with friends?
I don't know. I think you'd have to ask them. I'm not sure. Because even now, I still, when I'm in a group of large people, I'm very nervous and awkward in large group situations. I'm good with like a couple people, but so I don't know that it's changed all that much. But like I said, I still have a long way to go.
And it sounds like that was something that served you well when it came to doing the starting Tasting History, because if you're passionate about your thing and you're not self-conscious about like, well, I like this thing that's maybe a little weird, but I'm just going to do it anyway. It's a nice headspace to be in.
Yeah. It was the phrase, you got to let your freak flag fly. And it's so true. It's like, yeah, it's weird, but somebody out there is going to enjoy it. There's a show on YouTube called Townsend's, and he does 18th century cooking. Mm-hmm. And his show is very simple, as in, you know, it's not flashy. It's not your typical YouTube show. It's just him talking about 18th century cooking, and he wears garb of the day and cooks all on, you know, period cooking tools. And that there's something so magnetic about him because he's, I don't want to say he's weird, but it's definitely not everyone's cup of tea. But for anyone who is that cup of tea, who has that cup of tea, he's just perfect because he obviously loves it so much. And so that's, after watching his show for years, that's kind of, I've tried to emulate on my show. I've been like, yeah, it's weird and not for everyone, but you know, I'm going to do it the best I can and see if anyone else enjoys it.
How long was the idea percolating before you sat down in front of the camera?
Almost no time, about a month, I guess, 2 months, So it was last Christmas. We had a Christmas party at work, and somebody at work said, you know, you should put these things that you're always bringing us on YouTube. And I was like, oh, okay, that's fun.
Faithful and, words.
Yeah, yeah. And I had been watching this guy on YouTube called Graham Stephan, who is a finance guy, but he also would teach how to do his course or his videos, like how to become a YouTuber. And I had been watching it and never really paid attention to it. But then when she said that, kind of, I think it was probably like late December, I got his course and started watching it. And then from there, I just started devouring absolutely every video on YouTube about how to make videos on YouTube. And then it was a couple months later that I finally put out my first episode, kind of right when things were starting to get weird and, you know, society was shutting down and whatnot. Yeah, so it wasn't that long, but it was a very intense 2 months of watching hours every day of how to make the best quality videos. And I'm clearly still learning how to do that. But, you know, I do think that even my first videos were of a decent quality. So I haven't taken them down.
Yeah. And tell me about the production process, like from the beginning, and has it changed, like how you approach like a recipe or an ingredient or what that's the historical story you want to talk about?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the research, I've finally only really in the last month or so gotten down kind of my research method. And so it is starting to go a little bit faster. It still takes forever, but it is it's a little more focused, I guess. I don't wander down as many rabbit holes, though the rabbit holes are a lot of fun because they often end up becoming other episodes. Mm-hmm. You know, in those first episodes, I wasn't working off of period recipes. I kind of touched on the history of cheese and the history of cheesecake and everything. And if I was to do those episodes again, I would find a cheese recipe from the 14th century or 15th century rather than a modern recipe, and then talking about the history of the cheese. And I would probably try to frame the topic in more of a story form rather than a little bit. It's a little list of facts, just back to back to back. I think that my storytelling has definitely gotten a lot better. So that has obviously changed. I think a big change has been the production, like the physical production. I don't make nearly as big a mess in the kitchen now.
Sure.
I figured out how not to do that and where the camera is and everything like that. Mm-hmm. But also I'm starting to figure out settings on my camera, and I still have really red eyes a lot of times. People are always like, are you high? And I'm like, no, no, it's because I don't know how to use a camera. There's a reason that when you go to a film shoot, if they're filming a movie, that there are like 300 people for every one actor in front of the camera. Mm-hmm. And it's because there are so many artists required to make a show. People who know about sound and know how to light things. Lighting is the hardest thing in the world, by the way. And anyone who is a professional lighter should just win all the awards and be paid all the money because it's amazing. But cameramen and cinematographers and everything. And for me, I have to do all that, and I'm not particularly good at any of it. So, but I'm getting better. So I can hopefully be to amateur level here in the next year.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then there's also like something that I really appreciate. It's a very small touch in all of your videos, but there's the little hint of your partner, Jose, in the background with the Pokemon, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So so we always actually had, if you watch those first few episodes, it's not always a Pokemon. The first episode, I think, the first episode, I was in the kitchen, so there was no Pokemon. But I quickly learned that the lighting in the kitchen is abhorrent, and so I need to get out. And that first one, I think, was a character from Animal Crossing, who has always been sitting on our bar cart since we moved in. And I didn't notice him when I was filming. And he just happened to be in the background. And a bunch of people commented. I mean, a bunch of people. I only had like 50 people watching the videos at that time, of course. But like 45 of them commented. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. And so I swapped it out. Then I think there was Eeyore. And because I have a lot of little Disney plush and maybe Winnie the Pooh or Donald or something. And then Jose was like, okay, if you're going to keep doing this, I'm taking over. And because his collection of Pokemon it's lots. It's just massive and always growing. And so he started to always add the Pokemon. And at first, it was just kind of always putting one back there. But then I think we stumbled onto one episode where it oddly had a tie into the episode. Mm-hmm. And people loved that. So now, while we don't always succeed, simply because there are only so many Pokemon, we try to have the Pokemon tie into the episode, even tangentially, in some way or another. And people love it. People love it.
It's great. It's one of those little things that, like, halfway through the video, I'm like, oh, I see why they've got that one back there.
Right?
I get it now.
Yeah, sometimes it's really obvious, and then sometimes it's like, oh, you say this word three times in the video? Okay, we can go off of that.
Has it changed how you just like, I don't know, like your routine around your house? Because you're shooting this like in your living room and like with your kitchen behind you. Like, is it weird to live in a place where you're like, okay, well, our living space is also now a set?
Yeah, it is. Mainly, and I get in trouble a lot because I leave my putting up all the lights and the camera and everything, it's a pain in the butt. And so if I put stuff up and I'm like, well, I'm going to be filming another episode in 6 days, so I'll just leave it up. And after a couple weeks, Jose's like, can you please take this stuff down, even if it's just for a couple days? And so I, okay, because our place isn't huge. And so all the lighting and everything, basically we don't have a dining room anymore. Because there's that, and then all of my cooking stuff. You know, I try to keep it fairly clean in the shot, but just off of the camera, there's just stacks of bowls and baking equipment and all of this stuff. We don't have any storage. So I don't feel bad because it's like, well, you know, now there's a reason. I have a show to do. So yeah, I think that the major difference is that in those first few weeks of lockdown, like quarantine, he was still working. And so he works all day, and down in the living room. And I was kind of relegated up to our bedroom, or we have a spare bedroom, which is now my office. And I would just watch TV and stuff and work a little bit on the show. But the episodes were only, you know, 6 or 7 minutes. And it was a lot of stuff that I already knew. So there wasn't a lot of research to do, because it was just stuff that was already in my head that I was kind of pouring out. But now that there is a lot of research and the episodes are, I'm trying to keep them under 20 minutes, but, you know, they're 15, 16, 17 minutes. I spend a lot of time actually working. You know, now it's probably 60 or 70 hours a week that I'm actually working. So Now I feel like we're both contributing to the household rather than me sitting up and watching old BBC mystery movies.
Which also, like, not to look down on watching old BBC mystery movies, because that sounds like a great use of time, honestly.
It does.
I endorse that.
I'm not doing it 8 hours a day anymore, but I'm still doing it. It's just it's at a healthier level. I'm not going through entire seasons, because you know, a British series is only like 5 or 6, maybe 8 episodes at most. And so I was going through entire seasons of Midsummer Murders in one day. And that's not healthy.
Well, now you've got like this little cooking media empire. do you think of yourself now as like, all right, this is, I'm Max the food historian now. Like, is it changed how you think of your own like creative output?
Nope. It hasn't. Not one bit. And I think it's because, you know, obviously quarantine is looser than it was, but we still don't really see anyone. We don't leave the house all that much, except to go buy ingredients, and that's about it. So except for Twitter and Instagram, there is no real world application for how successful the show has done. Nothing has changed inside of our household, I feel, other than we like to watch and see how videos are doing. Other than that, nothing has really changed. So hopefully, eventually, I do kind of have that feeling of, oh, people watch me. And, you know, I have something to say here. But at the moment, not really. Nothing's changed.
I feel like when the day finally comes that we can all just like step out into the sun again.
Right.
Everyone's going to have been through this sort of like caterpillar in a chrysalis sort of experience. We're like, well, the last time I saw you was a year or two or whatever ago. And how have you been and what's changed? And I don't know. It's going to feel a little bit like a Rip Van Winkle, where you're just waking up and you're seeing all these other people who are waking up in very different circumstances than you last saw them.
Yeah. No, it's – and I just – you know, I can only hope that everyone has as positive as – of an experience as I have, but I know that's obviously not true. I mean, this has been a wonderful time for us in so many ways because of the success of the show. And, you know, Jose works on Disney Plus, which has obviously had a huge success of its own. So I do think that our transformation, I feel very, very fortunate in how we've handled the last few months. But I know that, you know, that's not going to be the same for everyone. So it's going to be rough in a way.
Well, I think a lovely thing that you're doing is giving people something to feel cozy and comfortable and connected with the videos. Cause I can talk to my friends about what I'm cooking from your videos. And it really gives me something to look forward to and feel, not quite so alone about, knowing not only are other people out there cooking the same things that I am, but they have been doing so for hundreds or thousands of years.
Yeah, no, it's true. And thank you for saying it's very kind. It was funny around the week before the election, when all anyone was watching was the news, I had so many comments and emails of people saying, thank you for putting out a video this week. Because I guess a lot of people kind of took that week off on election day and took that week off. And a lot of people were like, thank you for putting something out other than the news. I, you know, that 15 minutes of respite just completely reset my battery. So that really felt nice, that it was like, oh, I actually, you know, yes, I'm giving you information, which is the point of the show, but also I'm there's this other wonderful byproduct that I had not planned on, which is really nice.
That's great. Do you have things that you're looking forward to coming up? Stuff that we're recording this going into like the holiday season, so I imagine it's a big food time.
Yeah. So basically, December for the most part is Christmas, simply because I love Christmas, and so I am just putting the finishing touches on a video about making Christmas pudding, which is one of the personally my favorite videos that I've ever done. I think one of the hardest as well. And then I'm going to have my hand at doing tamales and talking about the history of tamales. Though I'm a little worried because, you know, Jose is Mexican, as is his family, so tamales are a bit of a sacred thing, and I'm going to be doing them somewhat differently because I'm going to emulate or try to make them in a way that the Aztecs or the Mayans would have done, which means no beef, no pork, no lard, and those are very important things in tamales. Yeah. They're also, you know, they were bald instead of kind of oblong shaped then and everything. So I'm afraid of the scrutiny that I'm going to get from the other half living in the house this weekend when I try to make those.
Well, it's great. I'm very excited to see how that turns out. I've never made tamales myself, so I'm excited to see going way back to, I guess, digging into the tamale archives to see like where their origin is and how far they've come.
Yeah. Unfortunately, there's so much that we don't know about them because really, you know, they didn't write down the Aztecs didn't write down things about their food in particular, and definitely no recipes. So everything is kind of educated guesswork. You know, there's some archaeology and everything, and then some images very, very that came from the Codex Mendoza just after the Spanish invaded. And those pictures are done by Aztecs rather than the Spanish. So we can get something that's not through the lens of the conquistadors, because everything that we know about their food through the lens of the conquistadors is understandably skewed at best.
Mm. Well, so with all the projects that you've got and the videos that are coming up and the way that you're able to incorporate like yourself, your personality, and also Jose and the Pokemon, and make it a really tasting history, a personal thing. What do you think that that Max Miller, who is living in New York and struggling a little bit on the auditions to be natural, to be yourself, what would the you of then think of the work that you're doing now?
I think you'd be shocked that I have a cooking channel, first of all.
Sure.
I would like to think that he'd be happy, you know. But definitely it's not what I thought I would be doing, but I love doing it, and I'm loving it more and more every single day. So best laid plans of mice and men often go astray, but is it awry, astray? But sometimes in the way that they change turns out to be a good thing.
Well, Max, thanks again so much for joining me.
Thank you. I really appreciate you having me on.
Thanks to Max for joining me, and thanks to everybody who makes The Sewers of Paris possible on Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/MattBaume to support the show and get back rewards. Check out my upcoming book, Hi Honey, I'm Homo, for a history of queer characters on American sitcoms. Visit my YouTube channel for stories from behind the scenes of iconic pop culture. And you can keep up with even more of my work through my weekly newsletter. You can find all that and more at mattbaume.com. The theme song for The Sewers of Paris is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0. And until next time, croissant.